I'm Basil Pruitt, the chairman emeritus as of Sunday of the program committee of the Surgical History Group, and Dr. Nakayama has given me the privilege of introducing this panel as my program chairman's swan song. This fifth annual Surgical History Group panel session, which will be moderated by Captain Eric Elster of the U.S. Navy, professor and chairman of the Uniformed Services University of the Health Sciences Walter Reed National Medical Center, recognizing the 100th anniversary of the ending of World War I. Dr. Elster, upon completion of his surgical residency at the National Naval Medical Center in Bethesda, served as ship surgeon aboard the USS Kitty Hawk while stationed in the Persian Gulf, and most recently deployed as a surgeon and medical director of surgical services at the military medical unit in Kandahar, Afghanistan. He has assembled an outstanding panel, including as co-moderator, Leopoldo Canzio, who also deployed to the Southeast Asia conflicts on several occasions. That firsthand involvement in present-day casualty care will enable Captain Elster and Dr. Canzio as well to orchestrate their presentations and the discussions to place World War I care in perspective as the beginning of evidence-based surgical service, surgical care in the military. It is my particular pleasure to introduce Captain Elster and the Surgical History Group panel, World War I, the Dawn of Evidence-Based Casualty Care. Captain Elster.
Thank you, Dr. Pruitt, for the honor and distinction of chairing this critically important panel. This panel comes at a very important time. It's 100 years since our involvement at World War I. I think you're going to see, although there's much we've learned, much has not changed at all, and there's more we can learn from the experience in World War I. We often we talk about, currently in the DoD, about a conflict with a peer or near-peer enemy where the casualty counts are much greater than what we've seen over the past 15 years in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Syria. And I think you'll see from the discussion about World War I, that's what our forefathers faced, was overwhelming casualties, and they were resilient and brilliant in achieving excellent outcomes. As Dr. Pruitt mentioned, I think we have an all-star panel to walk you through this journey. We'll start with an introduction to the First World War, give you the kind of the conceptual framework of what happened in World War I, how it got started, the world of medicine at the time in surgery. Dr. Canzio will talk about combat surgery advances in World War I, focusing on things like resuscitation. Dr. Smith will go over the evolution of reconstructive care. Much of what reconstruction is in plastic surgery was founded in World War I. And then finally, I'll mention the legacy. What I think the legacy of World War I is the robust partnerships that the military has with its civilian counterparts, which are really formed in that crucible of war. So with that, I'd like Justin to come up. Justin's very unique. He has a PhD in background in history. And he saw the light and is now a fourth-year surgical resident down at Duke. And he's able to really kind of bridge that gap between history being abstract at times with you know, what we do on a daily basis. So Justin, please get us started.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Captain Elster and the Surgical History Group, for this opportunity to present, and thank you all very much for being here. As Captain Elster and Dr. Brewitt mentioned, we're celebrating the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I in November. I have nothing to disclose. And in honor of that occasion, the college put forth this session to discuss the medical and surgical developments that emerged from this catastrophic social, political, military occurrence. And we're focusing on these three specific topics. My task is to provide an overview, or the context in which they occurred. And so I'll do so by briefly reviewing the military factors of the First World War and how the strategic and tactical considerations related to the medical care before diving into medicine, surgery, and a few comments about who was actually doctoring. Now, as a caveat, my presentation in this panel in general is going to focus on the Western Front for reasons of time, but it is important to recognize that this was, in fact, a world war over Europe, Asia, and indeed parts of Africa. So as most of you all know, World War I began with the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand in Serbia, which led to the Austrian Empire invading Serbia, and due to a series of alliances among European countries, the world descended into conflict. It was between the Central Powers, so named because they occupied the center of Europe, mostly the German Empire, Austria-Hungarian Empire, and the Ottoman Empire, against the Allies, with the Russian Empire on the Eastern Front, and England, France, Italy, and the Western Front, with the United States a late entrant into the conflict. The Western Front really began with the famous Schlieffen Plan as the Germans tried to outflank the French army and encircle Paris on their initial assault. They failed after the Battle of the Marne, and the Western Front descended into a trench warfare between 1914 and 1918. And really for 3 years, there was almost no movement, substantial movement in territory, despite enormous battles with tens of thousands of casualties. In 1918, the Germans attempted a final offensive, the 1918 Spring Offensive, that the Allies rebutted, and a counteroffensive in autumn of 1918 eventually drove the Germans back and drove them to sue for peace, eventually causing the Treaty of Versailles in 1918. Now, the First World War is known for introducing many new technologies on a larger scale. Many of these technologies also had medical effects. So the dawn of Army Air Forces really began the field of aviation medicine. The U-boats that are stalking the oceans led to dive medicine. Chemical weapons were a feature on both the Eastern and the Western Front, led to new understandings of physiology, and as many of you all know, actually led to the first chemotherapeutic agents at the end of World War II, which were basically a form of mustard gas. But despite these exciting technologies, the vast majority of the war on the Western Front was fought in the trenches, with casualties due to metal interrupting the normal body anatomical structures. But even before soldiers are wounded, they were quite sick with which to begin. So the trenches were unhealthy places. There was very little sanitation. Dysentery and other diarrheal diseases were common. There's frequently standing water, giving rise to the current diagnosis of trench foot. Bathing was infrequent, so lice-borne diseases like trench fever were also common. So patients were physiologically depleted even before they reached the surgeon. If there was one advantage to trench warfare from a military medical standpoint, it was the infrastructure that it allowed. Because the lines didn't move very much, there was very little concern of hospitals being overrun in a defensive action or being outrun in an assault. And so they were able to establish a fairly robust military medical evacuation system. This is the British model here, with permanent facilities that were well-resourced and included at the casualty clearing station and mobile hospital level female nurses who are much more capable than the male orderlies who would otherwise be assigned to these forward units. And so a sample evacuation chain, this is for the British Army, but is analogous for the other combatants, would have stretcher bearers who really for the first time were trained with several weeks of first aid courses, as we heard from Dr. Mayhew a couple days ago, taking patients to a regimental aid post where a physician, not a surgeon, would triage the wounded, attempt to stop bleeding, but really not perform any significant interventions. When the patients reached a casualty clearing station, that's where the bulk of the combat trauma surgery occurred, and then they would either discharge back to the front or further to the rear in the base hospitals for convalescence in Western France or England. Now, all combatants recognized the need and the importance of forward surgery, principles that had been elucidated by Jonathan Letterman in the U.S. Civil War and Luray in the Napoleonic Wars. And so they created units, whether it was the casualty clearing station or the mobile hospitals, that were designed to be as close to the front as possible. And many of these actually were within enemy artillery range. The goal of bringing soldiers as rapidly as possible to surgical care to minimize the morbidity and the mortality. The idea was great. The execution was markedly more challenging. So it was called no man's land for a reason. No man could stand there without getting shot or blown up. And so frequently casualties would have to wait until after dark before they were evacuated back to medical facilities. As you can see from these photographs, even after they were picked up by stretcher bearers, it was still quite a slog through horrid conditions to get them to the rear. And stretcher bearers suffered some of the highest casualty rates in the war because of their constant exposure to enemy fire. So average evacuation times just at a few hospitals or after a few battles are ranging in the 14 to 27 hour period. This is a picture of the Third Battle of Ypres in the upper left-hand corner. Base Hospital US 35 after the Meuse-Argonne offensive noted that our heaviest work was done immediately following the Samiel and Argonne Woods. At these times, men who had been wounded for 4 or 5 days and had only had first aid were sometimes received. And so this certainly affected the quality of medical and surgical care that could be provided, as many of the severely wounded died before they even reached the surgeon, and those who did get to medical care were again in physiological disarray. As Captain Elster alluded to, we also saw numbers in World War I that are really inconceivable to the current generation. An estimated 15 to 20 million casualties, roughly half of which were uniformed, occurred in the First World War. This is a breakdown by country of losses. You can see the United States got off relatively easy due to the short time period in which we fought. The major European countries lost between 2 and 4% of their entire population in World War I. So if you go to the United States Central Command and look at casualties from the Iraq and Afghanistan campaigns, you see we've suffered just shy of 7,000 deaths. And by no means do I want to dishonor those who have made the ultimate sacrifice for our country, but I think it's important to recognize the scale difference between what we see in the 21st century conflicts thus far and what they were experiencing in World War I, where really 7,000 deaths wouldn't even be a named skirmish. The Battle of the Somme, there's 57,000 British casualties on the first day. 40,000 were wounded, 50% of which were wounded severely. Base Hospital 44 supported the British Army in the Somme. They were taking 4,500 wounded over the first 3 days. I know many of you guys work at level one trauma centers, and I would challenge your facilities with all the resources you have in the 21st century to care for 100 severely wounded patients coming in 3 days in a row, much less over 1,000. So again, this level of triage that is necessary reflects the type of care that doctors were able to provide. I think it's nicely encapsulated in the U.S. Surgeon General's report from 1920. Typically, these documents are designed to make your organization look good to Congress so they give you more money. But they candidly admitted that it was necessary in some base hospitals for the bacteriologists, the ophthalmologists, the otolaryngologists, the commanding officers to perform major operations in order to do what they could to prevent the loss of life. And so huge number of casualties. Not everyone was seeing a surgeon, and this affected the surgical and medical care that they provided. And then finally, we see a shift in the mechanism of injury in World War I, where artillery becomes dominant. So in other conflicts in the late 19th century, particularly the Civil and the Franco-Prussian War, small arms fire caused roughly 80% of casualties. And in the era before machine guns, it was often single injury casualties. Whereas in World War I, it was predominantly artillery. And as British surgeon Arthur Martin noted, shrapnel makes for very bad wounds. It rips, it tears, it lacerates the tissues. And repair is often impossible in the face of anatomical devastation, much as many surgeons today have seen with the improvised explosive devices overseas. The artillery also contributed to the diagnosis of shell shock. Certainly, neuropsychiatric injury after military trauma can be traced back to Homer and the Iliad, but it received renewed attention and an explosion in recorded numbers during the First World War. And there is a whole literature on shell shock and neuropsychiatric injury that we don't have time to delve into today, although I'd be happy to take any questions about it. From a medical standpoint, internal medicine existed at a really exciting scientific time, but one with few therapeutic options. So in the late 19th century, men like Louis Pasteur and Robert Koch had identified and elucidated the germ theory of disease, which by the 19-teens was widely accepted. However, there are very few treatments that they could provide patients once they performed a diagnosis. There are certainly no antibiotics. And so the mechanism of the day was identification, at which they were very good, and there were bacteriological laboratories just behind the lines, and prevention. And there were a variety of strategies for prevention. One I'd like to highlight is vaccination. Typhoid is a diarrheal disease that have afflicted military camps since the dawn of campaigning. And in the Boer War, the British suffered just under 60,000 cases with 9,000 deaths from typhoid, far more than were killed in combat. But with the de facto vaccination of all British soldiers, they dropped to around 20,000 cases in the First World War with under 1,200 deaths, despite having millions of more men in uniform, indicating the power and potential of this new science to improve the health of the army. One epidemic they were not able to control, however, was the flu pandemic of 1918 to 1919, which killed an estimated 100 million citizens of the globe. Again, don't have time to discuss it today. Happy to discuss in question and answers. The other epidemic they couldn't control was the epidemic of trauma, as all these soldiers are getting wounded by the artillery shells that are exploding in their midst. And we'll talk about a few of those items this afternoon. Dr. Cancio is going to address shock and resuscitation, a critical topic, again, as these soldiers are often laying on the battlefield for 12, 14 hours before they even reach medical facilities. If you made it through resuscitation in the first operation, then wound infection was a primary killer. And again, this benefited from the germ theory of disease and recognition that staph and strep was the primary cause, but treatment was challenging. And unfortunately, the military's medical services of European countries took lessons from the Boer War and the Russo-Japanese War that did not apply to the First World War, in the sense that these two previous conflicts fought in the early 20th century occurred over relatively sterile grounds in the steppes of Manchuria and the velds of South Africa. And so wounds typically did not get infected, and doctors had a very conservative approach to treating them. But this did not apply into the trenches of Europe, where according to one British military medical manual, the earth teemed with microorganisms. This is farmland that French farmers have used animal manure to fertilize for generations, and wound infections were omnipresent. In one study, British soldiers suffered a tetanus rate approximately one-third of all wounds to start the war in 1914, with approximately a 68% mortality. And they recognized that this was not satisfactory and began making changes very quickly. And so one of the changes related to the germ theory of disease and developing an anti-tetanus sera, and the other was a return to surgical management of wounds, and particularly debridement, which before this was not a particularly common operation in military medicine, but by 1917, because of the wound infection, became standard of care for military trauma. And so you saw a dramatic decrease in the rate of tetanus in British soldiers to less than 1% by the end of the war. But surgeons realized they couldn't cut out every single bacteria in the wound, and so they turned to various antiseptic methods following Lister's tradition, the most famous of which was the Carrel-Dakin method. Henry Dakin was a chemist who worked for the Rockefeller Institute who developed the Dakin solution with which we are familiar today, basically physiological bleach. This is a picture from WashU's base hospital deployed overseas where you can see Dakin's solution infusing into an open femur fracture. And these are the catheters that Carrel invented from Kansas University Medical Center's base hospital deployed overseas that would infiltrate the Dakin solution into the wound to kill any bacteria that might have been missed in the initial surgical debridement. And this combination of anti-tetanus sera, of surgical debridement, and of antiseptic solutions like the Carrel-Dakin method became standard of care for military combat surgery really through World War II until the introduction of penicillin made them obsolete. One particular operation that's near and dear to the heart of general surgeons is laparotomy. Now, only about 2% of wounds that reached medical care afflicted the abdomen in World War I. Certainly, more than 2% are getting hit in the belly, but with the prolonged evacuation time, many of them died before they ever reached medical care. They applied, again, a conservative management strategy, which led to approximately an 80% mortality rate from this wound. And this conservative management strategy, again, came from the British experience in the Boer War, where they documented just under 210 abdominal wounds, and when they operated, there was a 70% mortality rate, which led to McCormick's aphorism, basically a man wounded in the abdomen dies if he is operated on and remains alive if he is left in peace. But the 80% mortality was more than they were willing to accept, and certain surgeons, notably Owen Richards, with the support of Cuthbert Wallace and Anthony Balby, began exploring abdominal exploration starting in 1914. And by 1915, they began having specialty abdominal surgery centers. This was not only in the British Army, but also in the German Army, that would focus on this pathology. And by 1918, the exploratory laparotomy for penetrating abdominal wounds became standard of care in military medicine, leading to a decrease in the mortality rate from roughly 80% to 40%. Now, importantly, they were doing almost exclusively primary repairs. Resection and anastomosis, or resection and colostomy, would await for the Second World War. The other operation classically associated with the First World War was plastic surgery, with all the maxillofacial injuries that Dr. Smith will be discussing in detail shortly. I don't want to give the impression that war always advances surgery, because I don't think that's true. And vascular cases are one example where, if anything, it took a step sideways rather than a step forward. Certainly, Alexis Carrel and his anastomosis technique was well known, having won the Nobel Prize in 1912. But despite that fact, ligation remained the standard of care. The U.S. Surgeon General documented 351 vascular injuries and 351 ligations. Amputation rate was noticeably high. One of the efforts to try to change that came at the behest of British surgeon George Makins, who advocated concomitant vein ligation, that if you have amputation, it's because there's not enough oxygen in the tissue. If you ligate the vein, maybe the blood stays in the extremity longer and it's less likely to be amputated. And certainly it's not something we practice today, but in World War I through World War II, concomitant vein ligation was standard of care for vascular injuries. So who was doctoring, who was operating? Well, in the European countries, over 50% of the physicians were in uniform, which made civilian healthcare challenging in those countries, an understudied topic. The United States started out with approximately 400 doctors in uniform and ended with over 30,000, or just under 25% of US physicians. Impressively, 90% of fellows of the American College of Surgeons rallied to the flag and served their country in the First World War. In the United States, they were all male, no females were commissioned, although there's a great surgical history poster about volunteer female surgeons who went over to France, and they were almost all white. There are a few black surgeons who participated in the all-black divisions. The Army was approximately 13% black in World War I, so you can see it was nowhere near proportional to the number of troops. The war did, however, provide an opportunity for female doctors, particularly in the European countries because of its prolonged duration, but also in the United States, where you see a significant uptick in the number of female medical students over the duration of the war. However, this dropped off precipitously back to pre-war levels in 1919. Because the average practice life is somewhere around 30 to 40 years, most of the American doctors had gone to war without the benefits of the Flexner Report and its changes to medical education. So they're medical school experiences were, shall we say, uneven. And the residency experiences, as Dr. Cameron mentioned this morning, were effectively non-existent. Certainly, William Halstead had created his program at Johns Hopkins University, but they were exquisitely rare in the 19-teens. So they may have had a rotating internship or a few postgraduate courses. The quality of the American medical profession was nicely captured by General Munson's article in JAMA in 1919. Munson was in charge of training and military medical readiness in the country during the First World War. And he found of those individuals who self-identified as surgeons, 94% got a C or worse. And this was a self-selected group, and that you had to have gone to an approved medical school and passed your state licensing exam. Moreover, about 74% were deemed unable to operate independently. And they're talking about appendectomies, not major hepatic trauma. And so when we talk about surgery in World War I, it's fun to recognize the heroes of this college, Cushing, Crile, the Mayo brothers, J.M.T. Finney from this morning. And it is important to recognize their accomplishments, which were real. It's also important to realize that these men represented an exception, a minority of the practitioners who are actually going overseas, most of whom, again, may have had a rotating internship or a few courses in surgery and are now expected to deal with these traumatically injured soldiers. So we've talked a little bit about some military conditions that influenced the practice of medicine, specifically the prolonged evacuation, the massive numbers causing triage, and the mechanism of injury. And we talked about how, at least since 1917, the combination of a germ theory of disease, more aggressive surgical interventions, and an organized military medical system helped care for the sick and wounded. A couple of after effects, and then I'll conclude. Many of you all trained or still work in a Veterans Administration hospital, and you may be aware that there is no single federal bill that created the Veterans Administration. Rather, it was a result of a series of legislative efforts that occurred between the First World War and the Second as part of the Progressive Era United States attempts to deal with the social responsibility to those who volunteered and served our country. And you can see not only was the bureaucracy created, but also the patient population, which climbed from roughly 3,000 in 1914 to just shy of 120,000 in 1941. And then finally was the publication effort. Now, doctors have been writing books about their military medical experiences for some time, dating back to the classic Civil War, medical and surgical history of the War of Rebellion. But what was new in this time period were journal articles. And on this graph, you can see time on the x-axis going from 1800 to 1900, and number of new titles of medical journals in the UK on the y-axis. And you see a steady increase with a pronounced climb towards the end. And so for the first time, really, you have dozens of articles in the literature coming out. I don't know what happened to that. Dozens of articles in the literature that are coming out that helps create this connection between the military and the civilian experience that Dr. Elster will be commenting on shortly. And then my last slide is a cartoon that you can't see that shows force-feeding the terms of the Treaty of Versailles to the German Empire, which was an undefeated country. And I like that cartoon because it was a great medical example of the end of the war, and also because the force feeding of these terms created the conditions in times of peace that eventually led to the Second World War, where unfortunately there were millions of new opportunities to learn how to improve our medicine and surgery. Thank you.
While our AV support tries to get the system back online, let's go ahead and take a question or two to use the time effectively. So I have a question and I can get started. Well, maybe not. So Justin, you described essentially prolonged field care. You also described how lessons from previous conflicts were inappropriately applied to the next conflict. You know, how do we make sure we don't replicate those mistakes of the past?
Well, you guys are the authority on the military. I've never served this country, but I understand there's something called Operation Reports Lessons Learned. And I think the British called it Lessons Observed because they realized they never actually learned from these lessons, and they end up repeating the same mistakes. So I'd love to have a perfect answer for you, but unfortunately, I don't know if, as humans, we're particularly good at learning from our previous ways. They certainly took the wrong lessons from that war, and I think it's important to recognize that each conflict is different, both in terms of its biology, its social, political context, the military armaments that are afflicting the soldiers, and trying to apply blindly the lessons from one conflict without recognizing the specificities of the next one leads to errors in management.
Thank you. I see Dr. Gross in the audience. Would you comment on how we can learn those lessons for future conflicts? You're an established military surgeon, long time of service, multiple deployments. How do we not find ourselves in the same situation? It's putting Kirby on the spot.
I would like to give you a very simple answer for this. Optimally incorporate the lessons learned. I think one thing that we can do is the tenure of our military experience, having an opportunity to continue to practice and give back to those junior trainees. But those are just things which we learn individually. Those are things which we do not learn as a system-wide. I think one key point that we need to do to ensure that some of these lessons are learned is that our military health system leadership would ideally be clinically relevant themselves and be able to adopt and incorporate some of these clinical lessons. I think Dr. Mayhew said it very well during her presentation at the Excelsior. And that is, she identified that the human condition actually prevents some of these lessons to be adopted. So I think we have to take on the perspective of understanding we learn individually, but also as a health system, and ensure that we're not bridled by some not willing to adopt and incorporate some change. So, thank you.
Thank you for that answer. I think there's a question.
I was just going to say you didn't mention anesthesia. Do we know much about anesthesia in the field in World War I?
Sure. So anesthesia was first publicly demonstrated, of course, down the street at the Ether Dome in 1846. Even by the Civil War, the vast majority, over 97% of cases, were performed under anesthesia. So anesthesia was the rule rather than the exception on the Eastern and the Western Front, both. There were very few formally trained anesthesiologists, and so frequently it was either the orderly or the sergeant. Chloroform was still a very common agent that was used. Endotracheal intubation was almost never performed on the Eastern Front.
And were people used to doing that available on the front?
I'm sorry?
Were people used to administering chloroform and so forth available on the front?
They got a lot more used to it after a battle with 17,000 casualties. They did have short anesthesia training courses that helped get some of these people up to speed. I think a lot of it was on the job training for many of these individuals.
Thank
just
you for that. Go ahead.
Quick comment on that. Endotracheal anesthesia was really begun at Sitka in England as part of the maxillofacial effort, because they try to use ether anesthesia or local, and if they gave ether, they couldn't get a good seal because of all the maxillofacial injuries. So the surgeon was anesthetized as well as the patient.